I had an image that came to me as you were talking. Well, first, two images. One was you said something about baling hay or hay baling of summer or something like that. I did that as a kid. It's a terribly itchy job. The farmer down the street would pay me $2 a day plus candy. So, and the other image was just, I'm not done with the conversations about the sacred, obviously. And last month, I think, was stirring around in some interesting and important waters, stirring up the cauldron a bit. And it is still a question, what makes a place sacred, and what happens to places over time, and what happens when we lose the thread to places over time. Like, if you were to come with me to Jerusalem, and I were to take you to the very center of the old city, where the Dome of the Rock is, that's the gold dome. It's actually an Islamic shrine. It's not a mosque. People confuse it. It's an Islamic shrine. And what you would find there is, first of all, there'd be a police force that guards it and keeps the peace. It's a mixture of Palestinians and Jews, actually, are on the police force that manage the Dome of the Rock, as it's called. And if you were to come with me, you would be quite confused as to what's going on, because you might have Friday prayers happening, Muslim prayers, and there might be 20 to 50,000 people chanting. And you might could ask me, what are they chanting? And at first I would say, I don't know, but I would know a few things that they might be chanting, which would disturb you on one level, and also might inspire you on another level. And then next to that, you might have Jews praying at the Western Wall, as it's called, which is actually the retaining wall built by Herod the Great to hold up the platform on which the Dome of the Rock sits, which was built about the year 800-ish AD, Common Era. That's a long time for a single shrine to be there. And you would also notice that the shrine, the Dome of the Rock, is octagonal, which is the same shape as the Byzantine churches and was probably made by Byzantine Christian engineers, which is odd in and of itself. And you would also notice, if you were listening to me as I was talking about it, that the shrine commemorates the place where Muhammad ascended to heaven, although it doesn't say that in the Quran. And you'd say, well, why doesn't it say in the Quran? Because it just doesn't. Just says, and he went to a mountain and ascended to heaven, and that's been associated with the place of Jerusalem. You think, oh, that's odd. There's no mention of Jerusalem in the Quran, and that's true. And then you might notice that there'd be metal detectors everywhere you went, no matter where you wanted to go. If you wanted to go to the Western Wall, or if you wanted to go to the Dome of the Rock, although you could also go to the archaeological park there if you wanted to. And next to the Dome of the Rock would also be a palace built by the Ottomans, who ruled this part of the world for 800 frickin' years. That's a long time. Some of you don't even know what Ottomans are, other than you've heard the word. So that's interesting. And then you would also notice there would be Palestinian kids selling bagels on the street, the world's largest bagels that you've ever seen in your entire life. They're about this big. And if you live in Jerusalem and you have a two-year-old and you want them to be quiet in the stroller, you just give them one of those. It lasts for hours and hours and hours. It's definitely not a gluten-free experience. And then you could stop by a modern cafe if you wanted to. You could grab a beer if you wanted to. If you climbed up on the roof of the old city, where there's a little secret passage that only I know of, and you would see hundreds of satellite dishes, and you think, this is odd. Satellite dishes and Islamic shrines and outdoor synagogues is really what the Western Wall is. It's an outdoor synagogue. And you might see Russian Orthodox Jews praying with fur hats on next to tourists with paper kippahs who aren't even Jewish, all standing next to each other. You'd be like, this is a confusing place. And you'd say, what are they all here for? And you'd say, well, the Dome of the Rock was built on top of the place where the temple once stood, which is probably 99.9% the case. The temple was destroyed by the Romans. And you think, oh, that's interesting. But what happened in between that time, and I'd have to tell you that, well, after the Romans destroyed the temple, the Romans built a temple to, I think, Apollo on the same exact site. You think, oh, that's interesting. And then you'd say, well, why was the temple there in the first place? And we say, well, actually, there was an older temple there. And that temple was built by Solomon. It may not be in the same area, but close enough. And you think, oh, that's interesting. And that was destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BC, if you want to be specific. And you think, oh, that's a long time for people to be gathering for different reasons. So like Muslims and Romans and Christians and Jews, and then an older form that can't even be called Judaism, but might be something like the Israelite religion. And then you would say, well, what the heck were they doing here? You say, well, they took this site. Actually, they traded in a land exchange after they conquered it under the rule of Solomon. They traded this spot for some Canaanites who were using it as a sacred site. Well, why would they be using it as a sacred site? Who knows? We don't know. The Canaanites didn't write much down. I think that's a long time for the same people to be gathering around the same mountain for about seven different reasons at this point. I have no idea why I'm telling you all this. It just occurred to me in a single thought as David Dean was speaking. And then you'd have to ask, well, what the hell is underneath all this? Well, today, if you go to the Dome of the Rock, which they won't let you in unless you're Muslim or you can pretend to be, which I've tried to do several times and I have gotten in, you'll see a piece of bedrock. That's all you'll see, a stone. And you have to use your imagination at this point. It's just a stone on a windy hillside. That's all it is, which originally had probably wild rosemary and flowers and little scrubby oak trees, whatever indigenous plants were nearby, just a windy hillside. And who knows why people were gathering there? But they were gathering there because of some kind of thread of the sacred. It's just interesting to me that call God whatever you want, the thread of the sacred, and in this case, if you follow the thread all the way back, it leads you back straight to the earth, a little exposed rock on a windy hillside near a spring in the mountains of a place that later on was called Judea, and today we call Israel or Palestine or whatever kind of argument you want to get into. I just think, wow, that's a pretty powerful thread. I'm saying all that because if over here was the promised land, maybe we shouldn't break the thread right yet and just go ahead and gather where there have been real threads of connection happening among real people, living and gone, connected to a kind of sacred conversation, which that's all I hope we're trying to host. You might argue with the word sacred, but I'll just use it for the time being. A conversation around what really matters and meaning and purpose and destiny and hope and challenges. And that leads me to the title of our new series, which we'll talk about at least till Christmas, I think. So I like to call it Born for These Times, Opportunities and Challenges. And I didn't exactly come up with this. There's a Sunday gathering team, which you're welcome to join. We always need new people. And it was kind of a combination of ideas that were thrown out for the next series we ought to have. And I'm really drawn to this, Born for These Times, especially because you've heard me complain so much about the two poles that exist culturally right now between narcissism and nihilism. And narcissism, which we won't go into detail with either one of those right now. We live in a very narcissistic and sometimes nihilistic culture. And that's why I like the phrase, born for these times. Because I can almost feel like David Dean saying, well, that's a lot to bear, born for these times. There's a certain belief that's held about the human spirit, which I hope you could hear in the background of David White's poem, which is, you are not an accident amidst other accidents. You are not an accident amidst other accidents. And that's what I want to try to argue for today. I want to give you three images to try to make my case for the fact that you were born for these times. And if that's the case, then we're faced with a whole series of opportunities and challenges. I mean, as you could say, every era is. Every moment in time has its own opportunities and challenges. But I think my hope is that you'll feel a certain amount of courage welling up to face the opportunities and challenges. I don't mean you have to run for office. I just mean you have to ask the question. What is mine to carry here? Even if it's something very small, like writing a song about October, which also is somehow also large at the same time. So here are the three things I want to try to get across. The first two really are Greek ideas. And I say Greek, but I'll put a slash. It's also in Hindu culture as well, which is interesting. Hindu culture and Greek culture arose almost simultaneously, but were separated by a vast Arabian desert, among other places, and had some contact, but not as much as you would think. And these two ideas kind of, they're like tributaries to the same stream, if that's the right image. Two separate ideas seem to emerge in two separate places. Here's the idea. The soul chooses the time in which it's going to be born. The soul chooses the time in which it's going to be born. Now, in your sophisticated, modern, post-Darwinian world, you think that's a bunch of bullshit. But another part of you says, no, that seems true. It's a mythopoetic truth. I can't prove it to you. You can take 23andMe or whatever those DNA tests, and it's not going to be on there. It's the math isn't going to add up, and it's a mythopoetic truth. The soul chooses the time in which it's to be born. And what do I mean by soul? And I'm going to give you a definition and an image. So this is what I mean by soul. Something like your unique shape. That's really all I mean by it. Your wildly unique, precious shape. You came into the world shaped in a certain way. That's true physically, I can tell. You came into the world shaped a certain way. It's also true just in terms of your makeup, how you ever got here. It's true from a biological point of view, from a DNA point of view. But even deeper than that, in the realm of kind of the mythic and the poetic, your unique shape, the way you see things on the deepest level. And the soul decided, just go with me with this, said now's the right time for this unique shape to come forth in the world. And you could never have planned it. Now we know that because I don't have to go into the whole birds and bees thing, but you couldn't have planned it. And if you want to get very graphic, which I won't, but just use your imagination, of all the really millions of options that could have happened in that singular moment in time, the mystery of you came forth, as opposed to another million other choices. That's very strange. It's almost like a little frightening in a good way to think about the fact that you're even here. So I like to think the soul chooses the time in which it's going to be born, and sometimes we need a little help, so we need to look at history and which I'm not going to do. I'll challenge you to do it on your own. But just ask things like, why did this person step forth to do X? Or maybe even better, like what David Dean was saying, to be a certain way in the world that caused a kind of rippling effect. Just pick any figure that has had a watershed effect on the world in which they inhabited. How did they do that? What confluence of circumstances? Let's just take one example, like Rosa Parks takes a seat on a bus. So, unless the soul chooses the time in which it's to be born, and the right confluence of strange events led up to this incredible act of singular smallness that you and I have heard of. Do you know what I'm saying? So that's my first take it or leave it. I'm not going to make much of an argument out of that. Oh, I said I would give you an image and a definition. My definition was the soul is your unique shape. I like to imagine, this is from the Strange Mind of Kent Dobson, that the soul is also like a stained glass window, right? And between the ego, our waking consciousness, and the mysteries, which I won't even define because I can't, is the stained glass window. And in my way of conceiving things, what wells up out of the mysteries, the depths, the unconscious, God, the self, who knows, the mysteries, passes through the energies of life, the vitalities, the eros, the logos, all those things that we used to call the gods, the energies of life, pass through the stained glass window, and that window refracts the light a certain way, certain colors and shapes and shadows. Are you with me with the metaphor so far? And the ego, our waking consciousness, gets to stare at the stained glass from time to time. It changes the ego. Now, I don't want to say a whole much more because it could be a whole talk in and of itself. But here's my point. You have a stained glass. That's what I'm calling the soul, your unique shape. And it reflects the mysteries of life a certain way that then colors the landscape of your life and who you think you are and how you see the world. That's what I call the ego. And we need that. And all I'm saying is, you didn't cook that up. You were born for these times. Your stained glass window was manufactured for these times. That's my case. That's a claim. I know we live in a world where you're supposed to back off of claims, but I'm tired of that. So that's my claim. Here's number two, also a Greek idea. And here I'm relying a little bit on Michael Mead. He's a mythologist and storyteller and is trying to keep alive the tradition of myth and story. But in any case, he makes a big deal about what I'm going to say here. But first, a story. So, and I'll summarize his summary of an old Greek story. But it's something like this. Just before you're born, there in the oceanic womb of possibility, just before you're born, an angel or a being of some sort lights a candle down in there. And the soul lights up. And for a moment, the destiny, your unique shape, your stained glass, your soul, is glimpsed. Like, here is someone's potentiality. Not necessarily guaranteed. That's a very Greek idea. Potentiality. All right? There it is. Lights up. And it's like the path before you is laid out in the oceanic womb, just for a second. And that would be wonderful, because we could just be born into the world, and just before we were born, this mythic candle gets lit, and we like come into the world seeing. But as you know, it's a little more problematic, and another angel or force or being, just before we're born, blows the candle out. So we come into the world blind. And that is such an interesting image to me, because on the one hand, it says you were born for these times. You have a wild, unique shape. You have potentialities. And there's a glimpse of it from time to time, but there's also forces that blow that candle out. And we all know people, not you, of course, who have basically done a lot of stumbling around in the dark for most of their life. And you can think about your own life, times where you've stumbled around. And be able to recognize times where the candle was lit for one reason or another, and you had a sense of, okay, now I know what's mine to do, even if it's just this one act, this one-time action. Where did it come from? Why am I choosing this? And it's like all of a sudden, something like old-fashioned word, destiny is present, which was there all along, according to the Greek myth. So that's the myth. So now a brief conversation what I mean by destiny and another word, fate. This is something I mentioned in a talk a few months ago, but some things are worth repeating. So fate and destiny, these are two very old-fashioned words. Like, nobody's really talking about these anymore, which means we should definitely be talking about them. So fate, from a Greek point of view, is the stuff that happens to you and happened to you that you can't do anything about. That's the simple way of putting it. Like your parents. You didn't choose them. Like your skin color. Like your zip code. Like the languages or language you grew up around. You didn't choose any of that stuff. I know our culture's like, I'm an individual. I choose all things. That, no way. You're using words that you didn't invent to communicate your individuality. That's fate. You can't do anything about it. You can try. You can get plastic surgery and fix a few things, but it's not going to last that long, you know? You're just, that's fate. And that's of course, in the Oedipus, I don't want to have a Freudian conversation at the moment, but that's the Oedipus story where there's a kind of prophecy that says you're going to kill your father and sleep with your mother. Now, who would want to, you know, say, oh, you know, life happens. So they do everything in their power to make sure that doesn't happen, which, of course, creates the very circumstances for that to happen. And nothing anybody does can change this. That's fate. You can't, those are the things you cannot fight or do anything about. That's the best way of saying it. And all of us have to suffer the consciousness required to to accept this, I guess would be the simple way of saying it. It requires a kind of fierce consciousness to say, yes, some things are fate. Now, that was my spiel on fate. All right. But here's the other idea. It's fate that opens up the possibility that one finds their destiny. They're related. It's like a marriage made in hell, okay? It's the circumstances, and sometimes even the terrible circumstances, where every once in a while, that candle is lit that was lit before you were born that says, now I see. I'm going to do something about it, or I'm going to step into the world, or I'm going to be a certain way. Or, as David White says, I'm going to carry what is hidden as a gift to others. That's someone who has recognized a sense of destiny. And that's something I actually believe, that people have destiny. And I do not mean it in a fatalistic sense. I actually mean it in a potentiality sense. Here's another way of saying it. Not everybody lives up to their destiny. How do we know that? Look around. I mean, not at these people. Look beyond these walls. And there's something about this dynamic between fate and destiny that I think is, I find it helpful, but I think it's important to keep alive right now. Because especially when we start talking about opportunities and challenges. Okay, what are the great opportunities and challenges we're facing locally as a family, as a person, as an individual, as a culture, as a global society? This series could go on until we're all gone, you know? So if we come back to the question of, okay, I'm born into the world, and the world is a certain way. And what lights my fire from time to time from a potential, from living into my potential? And many of you already know what I'm talking about because you've done that at various times in your life. You've stepped forward. You carried yourself in a certain way. You took certain risks. And you made a contribution, no matter how small or large, that felt right, that felt natural, although risky at the same time. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? That's that little glimpse of destiny. And so that's my second point. Point number one was the soul chooses the time in which it's to be born. My second point is that fate and destiny are holding hands. And even things that seem totally out of your control, like things like the temperature of the earth is going up. If I run it through this lens, I still want to say something like, okay, you were born for these times. What might possibly be lit in the fires of your own being. Might have nothing to do with, you know, switching from plastic to glass, or I don't know. I'm not offering solutions that are even necessarily related to the given problems. I'm saying that fate, the world that we find ourselves in, creates a pressure cooker. That's what I'm trying to say. So get cooked is what I'm saying. And here's my point number three. And you may or may not like this, but this is close to a belief I have right now. That humanity is not actually a cancer on the earth. That's my point of view right now. Humanity is not a cancer on the earth. It's very tempting to think so. That's the nihilistic conclusion. I'm not saying, like, have you ever read about how, is it grasshoppers become locusts? Yeah, grasshoppers become locusts. Are you familiar with this? There's not a locust species. It's grasshoppers that are in a frenzy of gorging themselves, and they grow to like three times their size, and they can take down, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres in a short amount of time. Human beings are like that sometimes. Okay? They're kind of like that. But I would not say, like it was popular to say in some circles, that human beings are a cancer on the earth. We are causing tremendous harm. I don't have to convince you of that. We cause tremendous harm to one another. We cause tremendous harm to the planet, to social structures, to meaning, all kinds of things. But I think that kind of thinking will become a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. If you want to conclude that human beings are a cancer on the earth, that's what will happen. That's just my opinion. So my challenge is to think more like, what opportunities does it create? We find ourselves in this world of over 7 billion people. And it's a pressure cooker. And things aren't looking good on a number of levels. So my question is still something like, given that, what is yours to do in the world? How are you going to show up? Or are you going to retreat into some cave of ideology, not you, of course, but some cave of ideology where you can feel good about yourself and plug your ears and cover your eyes. Thank you. So I want to challenge you to instead think about human beings as one more expression of the genius of how any of us got here. For 0.5 billion years of evolution, most of which nobody ever heard of human beings, that's just the Earth, and then 14.5 billion years of evolution, period, of this massive unfolding, and you're here. There you are. You made it. So I'd like to just say something encouraging, which is, you were born for these times. And there are opportunities and challenges. And take heart, you're among friends, or mostly friends, or at least friendly people that can support you to live into whatever small or great thing is yours to carry for the time that you have left. You were born for these times. You didn't cook this up. And there are a lot of things and difficulties and challenges that feel like at times there's a closing in. But I hope this series will be more like a pressure cooker, where the things that feel like fate will awaken just a small sense of destiny. Okay. My sermon was a little long. I'm reclaiming the word sermon, by the way. Mainly because it went on and on about the Dome of the Rock. I'm going to read 5 questions, and then we'll listen to some lovely music. And you can file these away. These are things that I want to encourage you to think about between now and the next time we're all together. What is my family story? I encourage you to write it out, your family story. What are the threads of fate and destiny within my own family story? Go back in time some, too. What are the things that none of us could do anything about, yet there were little seeds of destiny that were awakened? I challenge you to do that. Here's the second question. Do I have a sense for my own unique shape? Do I have a sense for that? What is my, I've been around for a while, so what's my unique shape? What's my stained glass like? How does it refract the light a certain way? I challenge you to really think about it, write about it, see what you think. How does my unique shape respond to the challenges and opportunities of the world that we find ourselves in? Fourth question. What are the challenges and opportunities we are facing? At the pre-talk, which is the first part of the Holy Trinity of the meeting that happens on Sundays, in the pre-talk, we just talked about that for 45 minutes. What are the opportunities and challenges we feel like we're facing? I encourage you to do it on your own. And then, final question, which you don't even have to really answer, but just wrestle with, what is your view of humanity, really? Do you agree with what I'm saying? Are human beings cancer on this earth? What is your view of humanity? Just wrestle with it some. I'm not asking you to believe me necessarily, but try to wrestle with, what is my view of human beings? Are they all good? Are they all bad? What is it? What is it? Because it has to be wrestled through, I think, in a fresh way in the 21st century. So that's all I want to say today. Thanks for listening.